You're listening to The Bill Murphy Show, the daily music interview show featuring the best in the business. From behind the scenes, in the studio, and on the stage. Available by subscription for free on iTunes and at BillMurphyShow.com. Brought to you by Lulu's Bait Shack, fresh Florida seafood and live music on A1A on world-famous Fort Lauderdale Beach. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
And here is your brand new digital broadcast for this Tuesday, December 6th, 2011. We want to thank, in addition to Lulu's Bait Shack at Fort Lauderdale Beach, where you can hear great live music, we want to thank the folks at PickTheBand.com, Roy and Company, and Jeffrey D. over at A1A Guitars and Art on US 1 in Dania Beach. Brand new, beautiful boutique showroom. Go check it out, musicians and art lovers alike. Today on the show, it's a big treat for me as we bring in noted elite keyboard player who's done work in the studio for or toured with the likes of Chaka Khan, Dave Weckl, Robin Ford, Kenny Rankin, Ray Parker Jr., Tony McAlpine, Jimmy Earl, Scott Henderson, among many, many others. The list too long to include all of it today. He's just returned to the States from another leg of the Steve Lukather Band's 2011 World Tour, where he handles the keyboard parts. His new jazz rock album, Steve Weingarten, Renee Jones, Dialogue, is available at iTunes now and at AmazonMP3.com. And on CD, coinciding with a special CD release party in Los Angeles, Steve Weingarten joins me. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to bring some jazz to the show, kind of expand the horizons of my listeners as I kind of get locked in that whole rock routine a little too often. So it's good to kind of mix it up a little bit. Let's start with that first before we get into all the biographical stuff. You know, you look back at the old jazz albums like from Al Di Meola and Jean-Luc Ponty way back in the day from when I can remember. And there really is, especially with people like Simon Phillips and others on your record, there's almost a fine line between jazz and rock when you listen to your stuff. Is there not?
I would agree with that. You know, the thing is, you're talking about the time that I grew up in music, listening to those guitarists and Simon, you know, when you played with Jeff Beck and
right
and all the other, you know, along with Luke. That's some, I really enjoyed that kind of music. You know, we're talking about early, mid-70s.
Right.
And that stuff is really strong, and that's what I just gravitated towards, and therefore, you know, it kind of comes out and the musicians that I hang out with as well.
Right. I mean, and the rockers, and I guess I'm a... Well, I guess we come from about the same time, but I remember the late 70s, early 80s, and those records that I mentioned before. You know, a lot of the rockers were listening to that stuff, too. And the shows, you'd go see them, and even though musically they were very jazzy, you know, the show presented itself almost like a rock show, and that's kind of what you're doing on this record as well, too, right?
Yeah, you know, I just love that time period of music, and I'm doing, you know, I'm making efforts to try to revive that on my own, because I used to hear stories about this too. I mean, like in the late 60s and early 70s, you'd hear stories about Miles Davis opening up for you know, whoever. I mean Dixie Dregs or
exactly right. That's my point. Right. I saw the Dixie Dregs open for ZZ Top. I think they did a tour
together.
So yeah, there you go. So there is a fine line, and it's all, you know, one big happy family when you really just look at it.
Right, and I think, you know, I don't know. It's just maybe it's my own fantasy world or whatever, but I always think that, you know, there's place for us to all enjoy things about other genres of music.
Exactly. Right.
And, you know, because my background, actually, when I was a kid growing up, I was really into classical music, because that's kind of, you know, my parents pushed me in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I have sort of an affinity just based on that towards instrumental music. You know, the rock and the jazz and the funk grooves and all that, you know, couple all that together, and it sort of ends up being, you know, some of the stuff that we hear on my CD with Renee and Simon. It just kind of comes together in its own way. You know, takes a life of its own.
And I guess in conclusion to what we're kind of discussing here, jazz, when it comes right down to it, is the bridge between classical and rock, you know? I guess
to kind of simplify it.
Absolutely. So, now let's go with start with your beginnings. We're going to listen to this record, which is really, really cool, and we'll get into all, some technical stuff, but we want to learn a little bit about you for the listener that doesn't know. Most of your work is based around keyboards, so I'm imagining you grew up taking piano lessons. I know myself, I took some and hated them at a young age. I had a mean old lady teaching me, and I didn't want to learn my scales and stuff.
Yeah.
How was your early days in learning the piano and the piano lessons routine?
Well, you know, it's not far off from what you just described. My mom found out that at a very early age, I have the gift of perfect pitch.
Ah, love that. I'm very jealous.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a curse from time to time as well, but I think based on she saw this ability that I possessed and decided to just, you know, push me in that direction.
Right.
And at that point in time, and, you know, I'm not from the biggest city in Ohio. So,
right.
I mean, we had limited resources. So she pushed me towards classical music. But, you know, when we were kids like that, you know, I wanted to be out in the neighborhood playing baseball and hanging out with the other kids. So I had that element as well. I enjoyed music, but I also wanted to get out and play. And there was a big push and pull for a long time until I just said, okay, I'm going to do this.
I guess you cross a certain threshold where it becomes, it transforms from being a task into something that you really enjoy. And once you cross that, cross that threshold,
right,
then it's a whole different story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just sort of, there was a point that I said, this is it's kind of adding up to what I'm going to do, and I'm beginning to, whether I like it or not, embrace it.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want to do these scales. I just want to learn songs. And they're like, you don't understand. You're going to have to learn the scales before you can play some songs. So,
right.
And I got a kickball game out in the street I got to get to. Exactly. I know how you feel. Well,
right.
This is really cool. You just returned from another leg of the Lukather tour, speaking of rock. And and obviously, there had to have been some nice little sections of jazz going on in that show as well. And I guess I saw you with Steve at the Canyon Club in outside of L.A. October 2008. Would you have been part of that show as well?
Yes, I would have, yeah.
It's a shame we didn't get to meet that night, but
that
was for the Ever Changing Times tour, and now he's doing this All's Well That Ends Well. Man, what do you make of what Steve is doing? He's sort of reinventing himself and, you know, he just seems like he's getting better and better with time.
You know, I have to agree with you on that. I've known Luke, it goes back quite a few years now. Since I've lived here, I probably met him in 95 or 96 and have been working with him steadily ever since. I mean, he obviously goes out on tour with Toto, which I'm not involved with that. But almost every other thing that Luke does, I seem to be involved in. And so I'm grateful for that. And I've seen him just unfold. He just keeps, as you say, he reinvents himself. He goes in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's always practicing. He's got a guitar in his hands. I mean, like, I went over to his house yesterday to visit with him for a minute. And, you know, there's guitars in the office. There's guitars in the living room. I mean, this guy's always playing.
Yeah. I think some players and some musicians, you know, kind of take that for granted that, okay, I know how to play, and they don't really see the need to continuously practice, but you know, you can tell by listening to Steve that he's still picking up more stuff as time goes by.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, we learn, you know, as musicians, that it's a never-ending process, and I believe that, you know, in the workforce today, especially in these times, that we tend to just go with what we absolutely need to do and refine that as much as possible.
Right. Right.
And in that process, I think we kind of lose our drive to improve and continue with our progress, you know. So, I mean, that's not good or bad. It's just kind of, you know, my little observation on it,
uh-huh.
My little take on it.
Of course, the circumstances change from person to person, but I see where you're coming from on that. Right, okay.
Yeah. And I think Luke is one of these guys who, and I'm inspired by the guy. I mean, you know, I hear all these new things happening, and to be honest, he's one of the few people that I've worked with for a long period of time where we can do things, the same songs from night to night, yet there will be something different about each performance. Right. And it never gets old.
Yeah, yeah.
Never gets.
And I don't think Steve acknowledges himself as being one of the greats out there. And he'll even say silly things like, I'm not that good. And that's probably what keeps him going. And, you know, I can't really tell if he's being facetious when he says stuff like that. But
yeah.
Well, who knows? Yeah. Whatever he's doing is working. And so this this tour went really, really well, I'm imagining. And you've got your wife, Renee Jones, out on the tour with you as well, playing bass, correct?
Yeah.
That's
awesome. Yeah, I sure do. You know, I traveled for so many years on the road. I mean, I started traveling internationally, I think it was like 1985 or 86. And I've been with her, you know, we're high school sweethearts.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, I mean, all this time away from her, all these years that I've been doing the gigs and traveling all the time by myself, the opportunity came up when our previous bass player with Luke Carlitos, when he went his way. Luke called me up immediately and he said, "Hey, do you think Renee could do this?"
Wow.
You know, I lit up. I was like, "Are you kidding? She's perfect."
That is incredible. I was looking over some of her her bio information and getting myself a little bit more familiar with Renee's style. She mentions among her heroes, James Jamerson. And I think in the photographs I've seen of her playing, she looks like she actually plays the claw style like James. So is there even more influence from James Jamerson than I even know about with her?
Well, you know, she's been playing for so many years, but this is her first time out.
Mm-hmm.
In front of people in this way with Luke.
Wow.
So she spent many, many years, and I can remember back when we were living in Cincinnati, that she was studying Jamerson back then, early 90s and in late 80s.
Right.
So there is a huge influence. I mean, she's influenced by all the people that you might think. And I mean, being a Floridian yourself, Jocko's from there.
Oh, right, right, right.
And spent some time living there, and he is a major influence. There's a long list. I mean, but you're right that Jamerson is a big influence on her, and she loves that period of music, the Motown period. Mm-hmm.
And for those younger folks that might be listening to the show who don't know what we're talking about, James Jamerson is the bass player on pretty much every Motown hit you've heard, all the Marvin Gaye great songs and all that. And there's some kind of magic that he sort of invented for all bass players, in that you've got the feel, you play very softly, but the notes are still powerful, if I'm describing that, you know, correctly enough. So.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
That's great stuff. All right, let's get to some of this music. Now, talk to me about how Dialogue came about. Where and when did you start writing it, and how long did it take for you to complete this record?
Well, from the technical standpoint, we recorded the album in 3 days.
Oh, my gosh.
We just went into we recorded it at Phantom Studio, which is Simon's studio.
Oh, wow, and, very cool.
And we just went in there, you know, in the morning and played for a while and got some songs done, and we just kept doing it. And at the end of the third day, it was done.
That's amazing. Now, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm imagining if you only did it in 3 days, then I'm just assuming that means you tracked a lot of parts together live, as opposed to, you know, layering from start to finish.
You're absolutely right about that. And that's one of the things I wanted to achieve in this endeavor. There's a lot of music these days that is, as you described, you know, stacked and layered. And sometimes I think some of the, you know, the editing and the machines that are introduced into the music take away a little bit of the life of it, you know?
Sure does.
So I wanted to go back to as much live tracking as we could do. And I can only think, I mean, Renee was stellar. I think that in the whole process, there was just a few places where we punched.
Okay, where you could go back and just change a couple of parts here and then. But that's great because you can still maintain that live performance feel, and it makes it so much more organic. That's really, I really appreciate when people take the trouble to do that. Now, it also speaks volumes for the engineering. Now, I imagine to get the recording set up so that you could track a lot of things at once, that requires a lot of skill. So I guess some kudos should go out to Simon for being able to achieve that.
Yeah, and you know what? I got to tell you that Dialogue, I mean, the name of the album kind of has something to do with the way the whole thing evolved. I've known Simon for quite a while. You know, I toured with him in his Protocol band in Japan, and we did a drum festival. I think it was Modern Drummer Festival in upstate New York a few years ago. So I've known Simon for a while, and I've been wanting to work with him.
Wow, so our circle of friends is getting even smaller. Would that mean you have worked with Andy Timmins as well?
You're right.
Wow, yeah, amazing.
Yeah, another great guitarist.
Yeah, who is just on my show recently as well, and we have a history with my brother toured with him on drums, so, you know, we have less than 6 degrees of separation, Steve. That's great. So go on. So, I want to get into the writing process, but let's go ahead and listen to some of this, and then you could tell me how, you know, someone like you comes up with compositions like this one that we're going to listen to. The first song we're going to listen to here is Do Note Move. I think it kind of showcases everybody in the group and kind of exemplifies what you guys are doing all together. Interesting title of this song, first of all, and tell me a little bit about it before we roll this.
Okay, well, the bass soloists that are going on, that's Victor Wooten.
Oh, wow, okay.
And Renee's playing the bottom. The whole song, this goes into what you were asking about, how long did it take to get this the music together. Well, this is a song that I'd written many years ago.
Okay.
And just rearranged it for the album. And it was, I was actually living in Cincinnati at the time. So this would have been in the early 90s, maybe, late 80s.
Okay.
And it just sort of evolved into this new arrangement. And I've been working with Victor Wooten over the years, and I asked him to be a part of this. And that's pretty much how it came around. I mean, it's just kind of fragmented in that way.
All right, well, here it is. Let's listen to it from Dialogue. Steve Weingart and Renee Jones' new album. This is Do Note Move on The Bill Murphy Show. We'll be right back. And boy, do those notes move in that song. That's Steve Weingarten, Renee Jones from the new album Dialogue on The Bill Murphy Show. So I think I'm getting the idea about where he came up with the title from that song. Right?
Yep, that's about right on.
It's a lot of note movement. Now let's make sure we give proper credit where it's due. Victor Wooten doing the bass solo parts of that. Renee Jones on the bottom. I'd love to hear two bass at the same time. Another recording technique that requires some skill. Simon, the great Simon Phillips on drums, who once again, when I hear that piece, I sometimes think that Simon is just showing off. And and then who I'm hearing some guitar in there. Who's playing the guitar on that track?
That's Mike Miller.
Okay. And that would cover, that would be all the personnel in that song right there, right?
Actually, Catiche Buckingham is also playing sax on the melody stuff.
Oh, okay. I thought that was like a sort of a synthetic part there that you were playing, but I guess that was a real sax in there. Okay, cool.
Yeah, we were doubling that.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, even better. Well, which leads me sort of to my next question. I was, you know, I'm assuming that you're one of those people with a really, really finely tuned ear. And, you know, you guys that are, you know, very particular about things in the studio. I'm just wondering, in this day and age, the way everything's been digitized, and of course, you grew up in a perfect era to be able to describe this scenario here. Now, with you know, the advent of all these digital instruments and modeling synthesizers and software that replicates the sound of stuff, is it even possible for you to get tricked by a digital piano or digital strings that software? I mean, can you immediately tell if something is real or not when you hear it?
In some cases, I can, but in a lot of times, it's just that the authenticity of an instrument might be buried with other instruments around it. You know, in a mix wise.
Sure. So I guess if it is played and recorded correctly, it is possible to trick someone even like you into thinking that you're listening to real strings, for example.
Yeah, you know, the what really gives it away for me is that there's a sense when you record a real string section, and this is true with a lot of natural instruments, when you record it, there's just something about the way the air moves in the booth or in the hall or in the sound room, you know what I mean?
Right.
And that gets picked up, I believe it gets picked up, if not like in an audible way, but in a way that you would feel.
Exactly. Very good.
The digitized reproductions of these instruments, sometimes, unless they're recorded in the way that they're presented, then it can sound, it kind of loses something, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've been using this drum software for live performances here called Superior Drummer 2.0, and that is some real samples recorded in real rooms. So like you said, the element of the room and even the room mics, which are adjustable on the program, which is kind of awesome,
right?
You know, can really give you the feel that you're listening to real drums. But over a period of time, the continuous snare drum might just all of a sudden kind of, you know, wear on you. Well, oh, wait a minute, that's sounding a little too much the same all the way through. You know what I mean? So
right. And I'm not sure that's something that you would consciously decide. I think it's something that you might feel.
Exactly. Yeah, you're describing it perfectly, and that's kind of what I thought you would say. And you know, but, you know, nonetheless, even with all that said, this stuff is pretty impressive that they're coming out with these days. And there's a lot more going on than there was in the early Moog days back when you first started playing, right?
Absolutely right. You know, the cool thing about this stuff is that it allows us as composers to get a better idea of how something might sound with, you know, like if you got a violin section next to a trombone section for a particular passage. You can kind of emulate that and just get a cool idea of what it might be like.
Right.
Without having to go through the expense. You know, I think in the end that we should preserve real players, you know.
Yeah.
That's just my own opinion on it. But I think it's a very valuable tool as a composer.
And you could put demos together to present to the labels and to your musicians that are doing your album and give them a closer representation of what you're trying to get, you know.
In some ways, that's really cool.
Right. But
cool.
As we described earlier, you kind of, you know, maintain that organic feel by recording as much as you can together. And I for one, appreciate that. And I'm glad to see you're doing that.
Great.
I want to listen to more of the record in a minute. But first, I want to get into a little bit with you about the songwriting. And in this type of music, it just seems like a very deep, unique thing to be writing jazz like this. I'm just wondering if, you know, odd time signatures and melodies that are very intricate come to you in your mind like the traditional pop songwriter has. You know, how does one come about, you know, the inspiration for the basis of a song like Do Note Move that we just listened to? So intricate. I mean, do you hear that stuff in your head before you start writing it?
My process kind of varies from piece to piece. Now, in the case of the Do Note Move, that piano, that crazy busy piano stuff that's in the bridge area,
right?
That was something that I just kind of was practicing one day, and I kind of fell into a little explore. You know, I just kind of went down this path, and I said, this is kind of cool. And then I started writing everything out for myself, and then I mated that to another part of this of a piece that I was working on, and it sort of, like I said earlier, it just kind of fragmented itself together.
I see.
That's a unique situation for that particular song. Now, there are songs that I sit down and imagine and intend to be.
Right.
For an example of that would be the title cut, Dialogue.
Okay.
I sat down at the piano. I wanted to convey this mood. I wanted to convey the feeling. And I wanted it to sound a certain way. And that's how I wrote it. And that's how it ends up sounding.
Okay.
So it kind of varies from one song to the next.
Sure.
The one thing that I try to not do is start with patterns.
I see.
That's one thing I try to stay away from, unless it's a pattern of my invention or my own muse of some way or another.
Right.
You know? And I'm talking about using technology.
I see.
As a crutch rather than a help.
That makes all the sense in the world to me, because it kind of gets you stuck into kind of a place that keeps you from, you know, leaving the possibilities more open.
Yeah, I would agree. I try to sit down a lot of times and just sit. I have my words here, I've got my piano here, and I try to start from those areas. And sometimes I might start with a drum machine program called Stylus.
Oh, yes,
and
right.
I might use a little element that's not a particular drum set reproduction, but something that's percussive, and use that as inspiration. It's just there's a never ending, it seems. There's never ending methods of coming about pieces of music.
Awesome. I mean, you really, really opened. You sort of said what I thought you would, and that was that some of this music does require, you know, the inspiration of the sound of the instrument as you're playing it, and sort of takes mm-hmm. you know, you go on that journey as you start to hear the sounds. And it's nice to hear you describe that, and very cool to hear how some of this stuff is put together. Now, I want to get a chance for the people to hear you play piano, so I've selected another track off of this album called Empty Chair. We're talking to Steve Weingart, whose new album with his wife Renee Jones is available now on iTunes and Amazon MP3.com. And we're going to talk a bit after we play this. We'll talk a bit about your upcoming CD release celebration, which I wish I could just fly out there and be at. This looks like it's going to be a great time, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Empty Chair. What's the inspiration for this one? And it's just a beautiful, beautiful, pretty much solo piano piece.
Right. One of my big influences growing up was Joe Zawinul, who was one of the co-founders of the band Weather Report.
Ah.
And he was a big influence to me. There was a biography written, I think it's called In a Silent Way.
Okay.
And I read about him writing a piece of music for a friend of his who had passed. And his name was Cannonball Adderley.
Ah, of course. Of course.
The sax player, right. Yeah. And in that time period, that was Jaco's first recordings with the Weather Report. And during this time, he said, I'm going to name the song Cannonball, or I'm going to name it Empty Chair.
Oh, wow.
And so I just kind of took, you know, that little piece from the book and said, you know, I'm going to write this piece with, there's little influences of his playing sprinkled throughout this piece. And I just, in honor of him, decided to use his own words and call the song in his honor.
Wow. Now, that story makes the song even more beautiful than it is upon first listen. Here's Empty Chair. It's from the new album Dialogue, Steve Weingart and Renee Jones, featured today on The Bill Murphy Show. ¶¶ That's Empty Chair. Steve Weingart from the new album Dialogue. Man, just beautiful, beautiful stuff there. I don't even know what to say after that. And if there isn't a more perfect case in point for what we were talking about, there's no question that's a real piano in a very nice sounding room, you know, the whole deal. I mean, that's part of the whole package. That's what raises the goosebumps when you hear songs like that, you know?
Thanks, man. You know, and I have to say the piano was a pretty mean piece of work to play.
Okay, so that wasn't just a one-take performance all the way through?
Oh, yeah, it was one take.
Oh, wow.
But it was just a piano that I was unfamiliar with.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it had a real hard action, so that was quite a challenge.
Well, one take, but not necessarily the very first take, right?
That was actually the second take.
Wow. Yeah. That's just super impressive, man. So,
thanks, man.
I am sure that hearing this interview and those two great pieces of music has really put it in people's minds to go out and get a hold of this album. It's called Dialogue. Now, it's been available digitally for quite some time now, a few months, and now you're just for the first time making it available on CD, which I'm sure people would rather have their hands on. Talk about this upcoming party that you have going on at what I haven't been able to experience this place, but I'm imagining it's like the coolest live venue ever. You're going to do this at the Baked Potato in L.A., correct?
You got it right.
Where exactly is the Baked Potato?
Well, it's in the San Fernando Valley. It's pretty close to Universal Studios theme park, and it's a legendary place. I mean, it's been there since the early 70s, and it seems like anybody and everybody has played there one time or another.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories about like Eddie Van Halen just walking in there spontaneously and playing with whoever was on stage, right? Stuff like that.
If I'm not mistaken, I think I remember hearing about Luke and Eddie playing there together at one time.
Now, that would have been something to see.
Yeah, a stack of marshals for each guy. It's a pretty small place, you know. It's not a big hall or anything.
So I could get a reference compared to the Canyon Club in Agora Hills. Is it bigger or smaller?
Oh, it's a little smaller than that.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's a real intimate place, and like I said, it's legendary. I can remember playing there, and I forget who I was playing with at the time, but I remember that a tour bus came in. Some tourist from Japan had blown over, didn't even go to the hotel, went straight to the Baked Potato. These tourists come in and they're digging the music, and next thing you know, you look over there and they're asleep after that long flight.
Wow. That is just, that's fantastic stuff. So the Baked Potato, so this is happening when? It's coming up, right?
It's on the 17th. It's Saturday, the following, this coming Saturday. It's on the 17th, and it's going to be great. You know, everyone that's on the album, with the exception of Victor Wooten, I know, I'm pretty sure Luke is going to come in and at least hang out.
Okay.
And I'm trying to talk to the percussionist who we had there, Lenny Castro, to come and play with us as well.
The legendary Lenny Castro. That'd be great.
Yeah, that's another character right there, man. He's a whole story by himself.
Oh, yeah.
He's great. He's so cool.
What a discography that guy has. It's amazing.
No kidding. Yeah. No kidding.
So this is December 17th. It'll be at the Baked Potato in L.A. Quite an event. The CD is kind of finally being released to the public in its compact disc form anyway. Dialogue with Renee Jones and Steve Weingart. How did that come about? I mean, it's, I guess this says a little bit about how the record industry works these days. It's not your traditional. This is pretty much an all independent release, is it not?
Absolutely 100% independent.
And how do you feel? I guess that has some good points about it and bad points about it, but there's a huge difference, huge distinction about the way the industry works today and when you first started making records. How do you feel about that?
Well, unfortunately, there's some downsides, but fortunately, there's some really proactive sides. I mean, there's a lot of pros and cons in that one discussion. One of the main things that really is notable to me is that these companies that exist now have the machines in place in order to put an artist in the public's eye.
Right.
Whereas I don't have that capability, and I'm not really a business person.
Yeah. Well, tell me about it. I know how that is.
Yeah. I mean, I just sit in my practice room and I write music. I practice piano, you know, all the time when I'm home. And it's not something that I find very gratifying to do the footwork. And that's a frustrating point of being independent.
Right.
Because I just can't tap into that machine.
But obviously so the good parts is that you have control, creativity.
Yep.
Creatively, yep. Bill, split it out. And then, you also kind of, the cream rises to the top, so to speak. If the music is good, it speaks for itself and generates its own momentum.
That's the hope, yeah. I mean, when I initially released this on, we just went with digital download initially because we were sitting there, the CD was recorded, well, the album, I should say, was recorded last year, May 2010.
Oh, wow, okay.
It's been recorded for a while, and I've been trying to establish relationships with distribution companies and record companies. And it's just it's taken this long to get to the point where we're saying, okay, well, we're just going to make CDs. I'm gonna take them to an independent manufacturer and have them made and make them available myself.
Wow!
So that's a little bit of doing.
All right. So in addition to the CD release party on the 17th, the CD will be available, I guess, at all the usual suspects. I imagine like CD Baby and Amazon.com,
yeah.
You can order a physical copy of the CD. But for those of you who can't wait and want to hear it sooner, you can get the digital download at Amazon MP3, who we're an affiliate of, too. So you can get right on Amazon in the right column of the Bill Murphy Show, or go to iTunes and get it that way. Get it right into your iPod and listen to Dialogue. It's the latest from Steve Weingart, our guest today, and Renee Jones, his wife, who plays bass on the record as well. Steve, it's been a pleasure talking to you, man. And the next time I'm in LA, I'm going to look you and Steve out, and we got to at least hang out and listen to some music together, you know?
We'll go to the Big Potato and hang out.
I have to do that. I can't believe I really have only been to LA a couple of times, and to think that I haven't at least stopped in to see what this legendary Baked Potato is about is just mind-boggling. But, you know, maybe, who knows? December 17th is a little bit away, and maybe I can make it happen and go out and join you guys for this party.
That'd be great.
We'll see what happens. Steve Weingart, thanks again for joining me. Hang on for just a second so we can get a chance to say goodbye. But once again, appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing your new album with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Steve Weingart. Again, Amazon MP3.com or iTunes, where you can get the digital download. And if you're in the LA area, you owe it to yourself to stop by the Baked Potato December 17th for that party and maybe catch some of that album played live on stage. Check us out later in the week for more new shows here at BillMurphyShow.com. Thanks for sharing and thanks for the support. And don't forget, if you liked this, share it in as many locations as you can. Catch you next time.
Subscribe to the Bill Murphy Show podcast for free at iTunes. You can post comments about today's show, listen to archived episodes, and like the show on Facebook by visiting BillMurphyShow.com. A presentation of Bill Murphy Productions.